I'm Simon Best. I've been a medical journalist for 40 plus years, and I took over editing Caduceus magazine back in 2006 and have been running it ever since. It's a quarterly magazine, started in 1987, so over 30 years been published, and it's quarterly and focuses on health and healing and spirituality.
So can you tell us a bit about your background? Is it more in medicine or in journalism?
Yes, it's more psychology, a couple of degrees in psychology, and then I was thinking of becoming a clinical psychologist, and then decided in the end to move into medical journalism, worked for orthodox publications like Doctor and Hospital Doctor, and then gradually moved more into the complementary side of medicine, and eventually, after writing articles for various complementary magazines, I took over editing Caduceus.
Well, look, we're going to be chatting about some of the aspects of the COVID virus in a minute, but I thought I'd start by asking you, since you've got psychologist background, something about psychological drugs, because I've seen over the last 10 years, I suppose, more and more evidence that many of these so-called antidepressant and antipsychotic drugs actually have a pretty pernicious effect, and that doctors, if the GPs, have been handing them out to sort of get people over, say, a psychological difficulty, but then they sometimes end up actually addicted to these things. Could you just tell us what you've made of the I suppose it's relatively new, this idea of handing these particularly antidepressants out and antipsychotic drugs?
Well, there's been quite a resistance in the last few years and growing evidence that they have serious adverse effects. These are more psychiatry prescribed drugs. It wouldn't be something a clinical psychologist is allowed to do. It's psychiatrists. And there's been quite a lot of evidence coming out about their potential addictive effects. Drugs like what are called SSRIs, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, have been gradually phased out because of the adverse addictive aspects of them. So this is increasingly being taken on board by psychiatrists and psychology in general, that the long-term use, as opposed to the acute use to get somebody over a particularly traumatic period, has accumulative long-term effects. So they are, people generally are increasingly aware of this, and so are psychiatrists, and they're modifying their use with various types of psychotherapy. So,
well, it'd be nice to think that revolution had happened, you know, but I think there's still quite a lot of people who are on these drugs for very, very long periods of time, aren't there?
Yes, sadly are. Antidepressants, particularly, obviously sleeping pills, which are not quite in the same category, but trying to achieve the same purpose. Particularly sleep has been shown, with a growing amount of research, to be extremely fundamentally important for healing on all levels. Chronic sleep deprivation will affect every system in the body, never mind cognitive functioning. So, yes, there is a growing awareness, I think, both by psychiatrists and the public, that you want to minimize your use of these drugs, certainly in the long term. But this has come about in many cases by media investigations, books, articles, research programs, and you know, journalists investigating and talking to people who've been on them for, in some cases, up to 20 years.
So what about this? Before we get on to COVID, what about the fact that with these, many of these drugs, that if you start to stop taking them, you get worse. In fact, you know, you can get quite a lot of doctors, psychiatrists will say, oh, well, you know, the condition is getting better.
Well,
but actually, the condition is getting worse, you know. So the condition is getting worse, so more drugs are given. And actually, it's the drugs that are making the condition worse.
If you're going to withdraw from them, you need to do it gradually and under medical supervision. Withdrawal reactions will be directly related to how long you've been on them and how difficult the withdrawal is. But you need support and maybe nutritional support as well. There's a whole area of medicine called orthomolecular psychiatry, which is focused on the use of giving the brain particularly the right nutrients in the B complex and other groups to support, you know, proper adequate brain function. But you're right, if you're going to try and wean yourself off, you need to be doing it gradually and with the support of a doctor, a psychiatrist. I think a lot of people, you know, increasingly having read articles and seen programs, want to wean themselves off it, off any long-term psychiatric drug. But it's a decision that they have to discuss with their doctor or psychiatrist.
Well, yes, definitely. You know, some very, very small amounts, maybe reducing doses by very small amounts. You know, we hear a lot, don't we, about these illegal drugs, but some of the legal drugs are also quite problematic and, you know, potentially damaging and life-changing, which is this new expression that they like to use. But anyway, Look, let's get on to Professor Angus Dalgliesh, because I know you've got quite a bit to say about some of his most recent discoveries.
Well, an interview with him features in the current issue, interviewed by another professor, Paul Goddard, who's a former professor of radiology based in Bristol, about Professor Dalgliesh's work, basically showing pretty conclusively that the virus was manipulated in a laboratory. With all the implications that follow from that. And he provides conclusive, or what he believes is conclusive evidence, and other professors and researchers in the States have corroborated him and backed up his view.
So how does somebody tell whether a virus has emerged naturally or, you know, evolved, if you want, or whether a laboratory has, you know, inserted some sort of change into what I suppose might be a normal virus to make it particularly nasty?
Well, in his case, in this case, he is arguing that the change to the spike protein in something called a furin cleavage site could not have evolved over, you know, to occur in the very short period in which this virus has suddenly manifested. You'd be talking years and years and years, and it is that and other evidence that he concludes indicates very strongly that it has actually been manipulated in a laboratory. And other virologists in the States hold a similar view.
So what are you saying, that there's something in the genetic makeup that indicates that maybe something has been spliced in there that wasn't there before?
Indeed. He specifically says, and I'm looking at the particular figure that he uses to show it, that the virus structure indicates a mixture of two old viral backbones with a receptor-binding region called the furin cleavage, which appears novel and perfect for infecting human cells, leading to the conclusion that it was manipulated in a laboratory. So that's the basis of his evidence and other evidence that he has put forward. He's published one paper. He's trying to get another paper published, but meeting quite a bit of resistance. And I don't know if you're aware, but the Lancet published a few months ago a major letter arguing that that any idea that it came out of a laboratory was, you know, conspiracy theory stuff. And then very recently has changed its mind and become far more open to the idea that it could indeed have come out of a laboratory. I mean, there's all sorts of agendas going on, depending on which view you're taking, but obviously the implications of it being manipulated are pretty considerable in terms of it all being an orchestrated event.
Well, I mean, yes, but I mean, it may have come out by accident, but whatever, whichever yes. It is, if it is manipulated, then, and if it is a piece of genetic engineering, indeed. Then somebody would have done that. And so I exactly. think the world needs to know who has. So is yes. there any indication of where this bit of genetic manipulation may have happened?
Well, of course, the only place is in the Level 4 security lab in Wuhan. I mean, that is why this has all occurred there, because the very dangerous, what is called gain-of-function research that was going on in the States was banned in 2014 by Obama, and then it was offshored by Fauci using his wingman, Peter Daszak, who's the director of the Eco Alliance in the States in New York, into Wuhan, where this research was then funded by Fauci and others. And although it may be based there, it's all a matter of who was funding it and for what purpose. It, as you say, it could easily have accidentally got out, but at some point one has to ask, why were they manipulating it in the first place? Was it, as many allege, to be a bioweapon? And if so, what was the agenda and who would benefit most? You could argue, well, the Chinese might if they deliberately released it, but would they really take the risk of releasing it with all the, to run wild all through China? I don't think they would. But if you ask the question, qui bono, you know, who benefits, then in the great scheme of things, it's Western drug companies who've benefited in the billions. And, well, it's a whole huge area, the whole question of agenda and
well, it's a curious one. It's a curious one, Simon, isn't it? Because you've got the manipulation most likely happening over in China at this level four.
Level four, yeah. Well, there are only 30 or 40 in the world, and the only one in China is based in Wuhan, which is why.
Yeah, it's in China, but it's US research. This exactly. is very curious, isn't it?
Well, it just adds a level of nuance to the whole situation. You know, convenient to have it in China, because then you could scapegoat the Chinese if something went wrong, either accidentally or deliberately. But as I say, who was funding it and for what a purpose? There's a whole question among serologists is whether you should be allowed to do this dangerous gain of function research anyway, and that you are asking for trouble from the beginning if you indulge in it. And that is partly why Obama shut it down in the States in 2014. But Fauci, for whatever his agenda, went round him and offshored it. You know, it was going on in the States. And then for whatever, well, Obama was advised of how dangerous it potentially was. And that's why he shut it down. And I presume he didn't know that, Fauci had offshored it into Wuhan.
There's been a tremendous sort of hysteria and panic around it. The question is that justified, do you think?
What about the dangers of gain of function research?
Well, no, I mean about the COVID virus, COVID-19, what was originally called SARS-CoV-2. Loads of, I mean, I would have to call it hysteria, because every time I switch Radio 4 on, there's another program about COVID and how we should be reacting to it.
It seems almost
obsessive. I know that the media like to have their, you know, like to sensationalize things. But anyway, do you think that
out of all proportion? I mean, you may have heard of a book called A State of Fear by Laura Dobbsworth. It's now a bestseller. Published by an obscure London publisher, but she outlines it there, speaking of psychological warfare, the subtitle is How the UK Government Weaponized Fear During the COVID-19 Campaign, and I'd highly recommend you interview about it. It's a total expose of all the methods they've used to create fear amongst and constant, endless, you know, diet every day of fear-mongering amongst the public who lap it up, sadly, because the BBC particularly won't seem to take any other view than a vaccine-only approach to the situation. And I think we know why, because Ofcom issued a diktat back in March 2020 saying that they should not give any credence or publicity to any therapy or agendas that countered the government vaccine-only narrative. And you can speculate as to why that was. Why the BBC didn't counter-challenge them legally and say, well, you know, you've got no right to demand that we don't give a balanced reporting of the situation, you'd have to ask the BBC directors, but it's been like that, and you know, you will never hardly ever hear them entertaining any other view, for example about ivermectin, which absolutely works. And you've interviewed Tess Lowry in Bath, who's the leading expert on it in the UK, and vitamin D, which again in the previous issue to the current, I reproduced the UK signatures of 220 world scientists on vitamin D who are advocating that high-dose vitamin D would in fact significantly reduce the number of deaths and health implications.
One of the things you've been looking at is this work by, is it David Branstein, Dr. David Branstein in the United States?
That's just that's an additional aspect which just corroborates the whole vitamin D and nutrition approach. Vitamin D basically, along with high-dose vitamin C, damps down the critical inflammatory response, which then prevents this explosive cytokine storm, after which the alveoli in the lungs fill up with fluid, and then you know you're in trouble. You're onto ventilators. If you can prevent that happening by either vitamin D, ivermectin, and others, you know, what they say is prophylactically, I say before you get into trouble, then it completely is controllable and manageable. And as for Dr. Brownstein in the States and his other doctors and clinicians, he has treated to date 515 consecutively presenting patients, not cherry-picked, as they present, and in all the four high-risk categories.
Sorry, that's COVID patients, yeah?
COVID patients in all the four categories of high risk, over 70s, Black or Asian, underlying comorbidities, and overweight obese, of which, sadly, in the States, you're now talking two-thirds of the adult population overweight obese, which is staggering in and of itself. And he's treated all these four categories, and every single one, he's treated them only with nutrition, a nutrition protocol. And everyone has recovered. Not a single death. Not one single death, which is absolutely extraordinary. But that is the counterbalance. That, but this you'll never hear about this on the BBC, certainly, or any of the mainstream media, because they're under this threat, legal threat, not to give credence to anything that would threaten the rollout, because, as I think you
know. Well, hang on, though, because the BBC will say, actually, the vaccine rollout has worked. You know, we've had we've been able to open the country up again because of the vaccines.
No, that's not the whole truth by any means. What has happened between March and now is we've come into spring and summer when everybody's getting outside and boosting their vitamin D levels. That is a vast amount of what's happening. And what you are seeing and have seen and see every winter is latitude-dependent vitamin D deficiency. For the last 100 years, for the next 100 years. Every year it is the same. And look at where the cases now are. They're all up Midlands and the North, mainly. Latitude-dependent vitamin D deficiency is what occurs every winter. And a vast amount of the recovery and the cutting of cases, never mind deaths, is that people are getting outside and boosting their vitamin D, as they do every year in the spring, all through the summer, right through till October. That's what they won't talk about. That's what you never hear Professor Whitty and his SAGE group and others ever talk about vitamin D, because they don't want you to know about it. There are no nutritional experts, doctors, qualified experience in nutritional medicine on the 50-man woman group of the SAGE committee. Not one. Who decided on that? Who decided to exclude anybody who would dare to raise nutrition and particularly vitamin D, never mind vitamin C, and only want to talk about vaccines? And these, be very clear, these are experimental vaccines. Okay? Experimental, as in not actually true vaccines at all, these mRNA, which have never been rolled out before. These are experimental gene therapies. And everybody are guinea pigs until 2023 when the trials end. So the idea that you would want to get involved with something that the medium and long-term effects of which will not be known for another couple of years, you shouldn't be coercing people to take part in effectively, you know, experimental trials, again, without giving them the full information to make informed consent, to give their informed consent, which is what, as you interviewed Anna de Brisere, she is emphasizing very strongly herself from a legal point of view. It is completely illegal to do so. And sadly, an awful lot of the vaccinators and GP practices have not been, you know, doing what they should do legally.
Well, so you sound like an anti-vaxxer.
No, it's not a matter of being anti. It's a matter of being using appropriate medical science in an appropriate way. I mean, let us take MRSA, you know, antibiotic resistance. Now, that has been caused solely by doctors overusing antibiotics. All right? Does that mean you're anti-antibiotics? No, it means you are pro using them sensibly and properly. But when it comes to anything experimental, you are bound by law not to coerce people to get involved in what are essentially experimental trials. I mean, that's what they are. These are experimental. We do not know and will not know for another year at least what the medium to long-term effects are.
Well, I mean, these vaccines are now being rolled out to children, and I am a little bit concerned about this, because I've certainly spoken to young people who actually wanted to catch COVID. They knew that it wasn't really going to hurt them much.
Exactly.
So they actually got it deliberately, knowing that that's going to give them some immunity in the future to get it over with,
and
really.
And long-term immunity, as in T-cell immunity, unlike, you know, short-term antibodies from vaccines for which you may then have to have another booster sort of every 6 months or something ridiculous. And the young people are, you know, the chances of them dying from it are sort of 99.999% against. You know, it is the high-risk groups, the elderly and those with underlying comorbidities and all the other factors I mentioned, who are by far the most vulnerable. And you could argue this is a huge waste of vaccines, never mind the potential risks to these young children who were never part of the original test that the drug companies did for 2 or 3 months before making these available. They didn't do tests on 16 to 20-year-olds. You know, this is just another aspect of it. And when it comes to, you know, immune system, boosting immune system, part of the reason that young people right up to, well, people up to the age of about 50 odd or more are so minimally at risk is that they are high in both melatonin and something called glutathione, which is a very powerful antioxidant and part of your immune system. And after 50, 55, it both begin to decline. So, yes, there's a lot of doctors now around the world writing open letters to governments objecting very strongly to the rolling out of these vaccines, these experimental vaccines.
I mean, when it comes to how you treat somebody who presents with the symptoms of COVID, I know there are all these protocols written out. I know I spoke to a woman this week, her daughter is running some sort of response in a COVID ward in a major hospital in Bristol somewhere. And her daughter is saying that, well, actually, she is told that there is no treatment for COVID. And that if someone does present with it, then they should be treated for pneumonia.
You may be absolutely right. I've also seen, as you may have done, that I think it was Sunday Times mentioned that winter flu, influenza, has apparently completely disappeared this year for the first time in 130 years, when it normally, on an average year, would kill, never mind total cases, kill 10 to 15,000 every winter. But apparently there was zero deaths virtually this winter. It is, you know, a number of doctors have talked about how everything, anybody who gets similar symptoms is put down as COVID in terms of whether they die or whether, you know, just as a case. I've heard other people warn that, you know, you want to be careful that they're not misinterpreted as meningitis, which is quite as serious, if not potentially more serious in the young. So, but I mean, these are clinical decisions made by doctors and others in the clinical setting. But it just raises the question of what is really going on and can you trust the statistics?
Well, you mean you've been presenting us with some statistics. This guy, David Branstein, let's just get back to him for a minute because, I mean, you say he's using nutrition and he's cured hundreds of people, but when you say nutrition, do you mean things like food supplements like the vitamin D you've been talking about or simply, you know, a particular kind of diet?
No, I mean specific. I'll actually read you what he says. It's a 4-day course of 100,000 IU, that's international units of vitamin A, not beta-carotene, 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C every hour to bowel tolerance, 50,000 international units of vitamin D3, and 25 milligrams of iodine. That is part of the actual medical nutritional protocol that he and his other doctors have been applying. So, yes, it is. It's high doses of nutrients. That's what he's been giving them, what he and others have been giving them. And he's not the only one. I mean, that's just a very impressive case, because I happen to know him. So I've been
isn't it interesting that the broadcasters consider that fake news?
Well, indeed. But, I mean, this is this is the whole fake assessors, or however you describe them, anybody who challenges. Yes, I mean, I know doctors who've tried to put information about vitamin D, you know, based on the scientific research, and they get suspended from Facebook for 48 hours or whatever. I mean, it's just, I've never seen such suppression of evidence and contrary views since I've been a medical journalist.
Yeah, I mean, it's and suppression. I mean, it's, we shouldn't really be calling things like vitamin C alternative treatment, because we've known for hundreds of years that, that, you know, vitamin C helps cure diseases. We know this, and particularly good for colds and to help the immune system. So one thing that does surprise me is I know Prince Charles has been a big fan of, you know, these alternative treatments over the years. Why, you know, he hasn't certainly been speaking out, has he?
No, I'm afraid he and other royals have been co-opted into presenting the vaccine-only approach. I don't think he'd be allowed to, frankly. It's all very disturbing in this, you know, suppression of contrary views, that one can't have an open debate and discuss the evidence and the science and the rest. Anything that challenges the vaccine-only rollout is negated, classed as fake news, and generally basically shut down.
Well, amazing, isn't it? Probably the most impressively evidenced treatment for COVID, which can literally stop it developing in your body within half an hour of popping a pill, is this ivermectin. What's going on with that?
Well, yes, the evidence is very strong. But again, well, you have interviewed Tess Lawry, Dr. Tess Lawry. She is extremely up to date. What's going on with that is that it is being rolled out in about 10 countries, as far as I'm aware. They had a World Ivermectin Day on July the 24th, which was very successful. And it is being rolled out in India, in various states there, and it has brought down the case load there and the death. And it has a 40-year history being used around the world. It's a repurposed drug in that sense, but a very strong safety record, dirt cheap, but it challenges the rollout and the money that is being made by Big Pharma all over the world from the rollout and from keeping up the fear level and making everybody think that you've got to keep endlessly having booster jabs, etc.
Well, and I mean,
the vaccine does not stop you getting it again. What it claims is that it'll reduce the severity of symptoms. Well, ivermectin and, as I said, glutathione will definitely reduce the severity of symptoms. But just to give you an indication of where it's, of the legal cases that are now being launched all around the world, and I know two here, one in Germany, the Indian Bar Association is suing the WHO for alleged disinformation against ivermectin, which is pretty unprecedented. You know, they are so incensed by the disinformation campaign coming out of WHO, which is pretty well bought and paid for nowadays by Bill Gates, that they've launched a legal action against them. And that's the Indian Bar Association. You haven't heard that on the BBC or any other main media. And you won't.
So do you think it's about money? Is it just about money?
Yes,
or is there more to it than that?
Well, we haven't got time to go into all the possible agendas of the Great Reset and the rest of it. You can find enough online about that. But when so many here, journalists and doctors and scientists who are trying to get the truth out, both here and in the States, and it's worse in the States, where people like Dr. McCullough have had, you know, death threats and have had to withdraw information on nutrition from his website under all these threats, it tells you something that there's some agenda going on where you can't have normal, open, informed debate as you would in any other area. That they have to shut it down, because if they give any credence to vitamin D, ivermectin, you know, other therapies that actually work, then the whole rollout is legally null and void. It becomes illegal, because that's the criteria on which the emergency authorization is issued, that there is no alternative or other therapy that works. So you've got to rubbish everything else. Otherwise, the experimental rollout comes to an immediate halt.
Well, I mean, it could be, from what you've said, that the entire emergency vaccine rollout program, which was approved by the regulators, the MHRA and their chief, June Rain, back at the beginning of the year, the whole thing has been unlawful.
Well, that would be what various legal people would say, and as you heard what Anna de Bruyser had to say, and she's far more informed about it than I am from the legal point of view. But indeed, that could be. If you want to give credence to these alternatives, and ivermectin most certainly does work, and it is being used in countries where you don't have such a severe suppressive medical regime that, you know, blocks it and stops it or threatens doctors who would use it.
But it could also be that in some countries they can't afford to pay the high prices for the vaccine.
Absolutely right on. It's all a matter of, you know, why would you not look first? Why would you not apply Occam's razor and say, well, let's look first at nutrition, then let's look at cheap repurposed drugs like ivermectin, and then if it's still, you know, we haven't got it under control, then we'll consider extremely experimental mRNA gene therapies. But we will see where it goes from now. I had heard recently that some of those now being infected, 54% of them have already been vaccinated. And as they said, it doesn't stop you getting it again. Which is why the alternative scenario of boosting, ultimately all you've got is your immune system. And that is composed full of nutrients, not full of drugs. And that's what I've been focusing on in the current issue. And that's why Brownstein's work is so significant. But he is by no means the only one. I know a number of doctors in this country who've taken a similar approach and had similar success.
Could you just say a little bit more about this Dr. Mercola? I mean, that sounds pretty extraordinary, that a doctor is making a diagnosis, publishing it on his website, and then being forced legally to withdraw that. I mean, a doctor surely is free to make a diagnosis. They can't tell the doctor that you can't do that.
Well, surely. I'm afraid in the States it's far more draconian. A doctor can be threatened to have their license taken away and stopped from practicing, and that, you know, is critical for them because that's their livelihood. So, yeah, I'm afraid over there it's far worse than it is here, in my opinion. But he's written a book called The Truth About COVID-19, which is on his website, mercola.com, and you'll see there that he states that, you know, he's been forced and threatened to take down, you know, nutritional information about vitamin D, vitamin C, zinc, selenium, iodine, etc., because in their opinion, there's no other treatment except the vaccine. That's basically their view. And Big Pharma is very, very powerful in the States in terms of lobbying Congress, etc. Well, the biggest lobbyer. It's pretty Orwellian when you dig down into, you know, when you get scientists and doctors being threatened and ordered not to promote things on websites or speak out or have their scientific papers rejected for spurious reasons, you know that some other agenda is going on.
Your magazine's subtitle is Health, Healing and Spirituality, and I quite like, particularly putting those last two together, this whole idea of whether, you know, spiritual things, prayer, that kind of thing can actually help heal people, whether it's, you know, mind over matter, really does mean something when it comes to health.
I think it does. I mean, many of us say they know it does. There's an area of psychology called psychoneuroimmunology, which is all about the ability of the mind state to affect your immune function. People are, you know, very angry, very anxious, or traumatized. It will have a direct effect on your immune system. A lot of which is based in your gut microbiome. For certain illnesses and problems, meditation, relaxation-related practices like that can be very beneficial in terms of boosting the immune system, maintaining it, to enable people to recover. It would be only an adjunctive, as they call it, therapy, rather than a therapy in and of its own right. But it is being used. It's used in oncology and cancer treatments to help boost the immune system when it's been very affected and compromised. And there is definitely, I think most physicians would recognize a psychological dimension to any healing process. As for the higher spiritual level, there's been some evidence and studies, but I'm not talking vis-a-vis COVID, by the way. But yes, there's a certain amount of evidence that supports taking a spiritual approach to help alleviate symptoms and help boost the immune system.
Okay, Simon Best, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.